Hello, thank you. Thank you all for coming. Let me begin by dropping my note on the floor. I should ask you, as I generally do at do's like this, if you would kindly turn to the person on your right before we begin and say, doesn't she look thinner in real life? I find it, you know, it stops you having to mumble it all the way through the first 10 minutes. Thinner in real life, thinner in real life. Sounds like Chris Eubank, doesn't it? Thinner in real life. You know, so this will be a kind of unconnected, eclectic, egocentric, probably unconnected and concentric, if I go on like this any longer, ramble, meander through the life and times of a 54-year-old, well, actually 64 if you read The Sun, 24 if you read the Jewish Chronicle, I'm sure you do, actress, author, mother of two, wife of one, lover of Radio 4, and I mean that. The title of this show, That Reminds Me, I'm afraid the thing that reminds me of is, that reminds me of a joke. And it's quite interesting because women don't normally tell jokes and normally even like jokes. You know, I know they roll their eyes when I start telling them, but it's just one of those things. I've always loved jokes. It's great, actually, to think of how comedians became comedians. I mean, I'm not really a comedian. I see myself as an actor with funny legs. And I found out not that long ago that I suffer from something called hypermobility, which is why I've got funny legs. You can't see them now, but I promise you, my legs have been reviewed separately from my performances in the past. And the normal habitat for a comic, you know, is just in the way that the natural habitat for a truffle is under a damp root with a sniffling pig with wonderful olfactory senses nearby. So the natural habitat for a comedian is probably a terribly grimy and deprived youth. Eight siblings in one bedroom and, you know, one pair of slippers between the eight of them. And abusive father, alcoholic mother, you know, you name it. Well, that breeds the kind of wonderful Les Dawson plump comic that we all know and love. And it gives you the right to say things like, my dad used to breed ferrets, which was a surprise to a lot of people because they thought they did it themselves. Or when the fella came round collecting for the orphanage, my dad gave him my brother. This sort of thing. These are Les's jokes, obviously. And they're wonderful jokes. But, I mean, if you come from a middle-class home in Hull, it's not quite the same. The only thing I can complain about, really, in my comfortable Hull childhood, Hull being twinned with Sierra Leone, by the way, naturally, was that my mother made me overly aware of matching accessories. Now, you can't base an act on that. But you do also perhaps need ethnic roots, buck teeth, glasses, and on some of those counts I would score up there with the best of them. And I think probably as a child, I was a funny child because my brother was cleverer and prettier than me. And that, you know, you need that kind of a start. One of the things that's great about today is that it's not an after-dinner speech, so I haven't had to have dinner. Because that's the hardest thing about talking, you know. I mean, it's just that pit of your stomach feeling all the way through the meal. And the meal is nearly always, you start with prawn cocktail, then you have pork chops, and then you have cheese, chocolate, red wine, which is a perfect dinner for a Jewish migraine sufferer. So, you know, and in fact, one year I was kindly judged an after-dinner speaker of the year, and it was in a momentous occasion. It was Princess Anne gave me the award. And as always with these things, your nerves set in, but something comes out of it which later you can make a column out of, which is my entire mission in life, is to fill that column in the back of Good Housekeeping once a month. I've been doing it for 12 years, and there are times when I'm desperate. Please, God, let something happen to me this week. But on this occasion, I was seated next to Princess Anne, Princess Royal, and as usual, Mother came too. Mother, who is now opening shops and cutting ribbons and, you know, the famous Zelma. And I always mean not to get sidetracked onto Zelma when I talk to people, but it's sort of inevitable because she's fed my comedy throughout my life, inadvertently. And on this occasion, throughout the meal, I was chatting to the princess and to the person on my right. And it's just this wonderful thing about royalty is that, you know, they never actually have a proper conversation because you go brain dead the minute they speak to you. And they're perfectly normal. There's nothing wrong with them. They could talk to anybody. And my God, they have to, don't they? No. Does that sprocket fit into that flange? How interesting. You know? 3 or 4 times a day. So she was chatting to me and I was doing fine in return. I wasn't doing my normal thing, which I do with royalty, which is to start speaking backwards. How is the show doing? Well, tourist week last, not many this week. Oh, that's a good mum. And Princess Anne said something to me and I suddenly heard psst, psst. And I turned around. I said, "What is it, Mother?" She said, "Me bridge has come out in the lamb." So I said, "Would you excuse me, Mum?" And I got up and I went with my mother to the ladies' room. And believe it or not, I screwed the thing back into her tooth using 2 or maybe even 3 pair of glasses, you know, and flaps and everything. I screwed this in and I said, "Now, for God's sake, Mother, don't eat and don't talk. Spot the deliberate mistake in that sentence." So we went back and I carried on talking. "So sorry, Mum," carried on talking, and suddenly, psst, psst. "It's come out again in the dessert." "So, would you excuse me, Mum?" I screwed it back yet again. And this time when I came back, she was looking a little curious. And I said, "I'm so sorry, Mum. But I bet I've just done something for my mother that you've never done for yours." And growing up in Hull, such a funny place. And it's so funny that I should grow up in a place where the telephone was the only private system in England and then end up doing the wretched BT commercials. You see. But it's, you know, when I went for the auditions for the BT character, you know, I was 40 and they needed someone who was a bit older, but I've always looked 40. In fact, it's good now because I can look 40 now when I'm not, you see. So it's quite... Oh, God. Oh, yes, I do. Oh, no, you don't. But when I went for that interview, it was like today. There was a huge, wide brief. They didn't actually tell me what she was like or what sort of... And I said, you know, "Well, I can offer you 2 Jewish mothers." Which is not bad, actually. You know? And the first one is my own mother. And, you know, I have a thing about voices. My own mother is funny because she has a funny voice. And I can't really explain it to you, except that it's got a funny tone. It's not exactly shouting, but it's very emphatic. And if you know a lot of northern comics, you know, it's Dora Bryan, for example, Thora Her. You know, there is that very, you know, they're going to tell you about it whether you like it or not. And then I said, "But I could give you another Jewish mother, which is much more recognizable, sort of South London." And I improvised a conversation to the butcher. This improvisation was the, you know, the sort of latent beaty, really. And it was, "Hello, Clive, are you there? I want 1.5 pounds of brisket, no fat. How's your mother?" "Oh, well, listen, a lot of people manage with only one these days. I want lamb chops. I don't want any gristle. Have you got any pressed beef? Is she walking yet?" "And some liver." "Yes, I want 1.5 pounds of liver." "What do you mean, what sort? Calves. What do you think, I want pigs? Don't be ridiculous." And, they presumably went back and bought that beaty. And we tried all sorts of makeup to make me look more rattled, but I looked rattled anyway, so, you know. So in the end, they picked that one, of course, and in the end it was just a wig and a pair of glasses and just feeling crabby. Also what I love to listen for, now that I've become aware of voices and what makes, is that there are people who are not really actors. "Tend to speak, you know, between 2 registers." And that's why when you get a model on a film, you know, you think, she looks absolutely beautiful and she can probably act, but she talks like this. And the greatest example of that, of course, is Anne Widdecombe. Really not decided exactly where she's going to speak. And they sort of manufactured voices, you know, like Mrs. Thatcher, clearly. And I used to love the story, again, that reminds me, the story of the cavalcade of cars with Margaret Thatcher going past, and she sees this man in the street begging, and he's got a placard saying Falklands veteran, and she stops the cavalcade and she gets out the car and she does that wonderful "Here's me, Ed, me bum's coming later" walk across the road with a £1,000 handbag draped over her wrist. And she gets up to the man and she says, "My poor dear man, I can't tell you how much sympathy I have for you. Thank you so much for giving everything that you did to the war effort. May I give you this £30? And I hope you find something you can do with it." And he says, "Muchas gracias, señora." Now, there's a theory. There's a wonderful voice coach called Joan Washington. And when she was teaching me the kind of prairie accent for Oklahoma, I don't know if any of you saw Oklahoma, but the whole thing about it was that you got to keep the accent way back in the throat, and you got to make your mouth like a pillar box. Actually, this is very indiscreet, but I hope they'll cut it out. One night, the Blairs came to see Oklahoma, and Cherie said to me, "You know, how do you do the accent?" And I heard myself saying, "Well, whole thing is, you got to keep your mouth like a pillar box." And we had this absolutely wonderful young man playing the lead in Oklahoma, an Australian who was as good and as nice and as funny as he was unspeakably handsome. And we would do anything to make Hugh laugh. Hugh Jackman was his name, which included in the last scene of Oklahoma, which is a terrific show at the National Theatre and one of the high points, certainly, of my career. Because it was just so exhilarating, such a good production. And there was a trial scene at the end, and I am the worst corpser in the world. You know, corpsing means laughing when you shouldn't. And what they didn't do to that boy in the scenes, I don't know how he lived through it. You know, "There's a bright golden haze on the meadow, there's a bright golden haze on the meadow, or the corn is as high as an elephant's eye." And that little brown maverick is winking its eye, 7 men mooning him in the wings. I should just tell you one other thing about Oklahoma, which is that royalty loved it. And we had a sort of royalty day where the Queen suddenly decided she didn't know enough about the theatre, and so she came to see lots of plays in a day, and then some of us had to have lunch with her. And for some reason, we did the show, and the Duke of Edinburgh, of course, had been sent to Chicago with all the young women in basques, you know, strapless, straddling chairs. You know, that's how he found out about the theatre. And and then we went, I had to get changed into all my glad rags and go to the Ivy to sit down and have lunch. And I was next but one to Her Majesty, and Jonathan Miller was in between us, so I didn't have to worry about speech. He took care of the whole thing. And then there's just one sublime moment during the meal where this wonderful waiter that they have at the Ivy was hovering behind the Queen, waiting to pour her coffee, but Jonathan Miller was talking. So he never got near, and he leant across and poured her coffee. And then he was just about to pour the milk when Jonathan Miller got hold of her again. And he turned and said to me, "Does she take sugar?" Therefore, I understand it, you know, very much when people, you know, when people get nervous when they meet me. You know, a lot of actors find the business of meeting the public very trying, and they wear big sunglasses and try to look like Hugh Grant. And I don't have that problem because I quite like people coming up to me as long as they don't try to kill me or set their dog on me or anything. But, you know, it's that wonderful thing of being somewhere, which happened to me once, and a lady coming up, covered in embarrassment, "I hope you don't mind me bothering you. I'm sorry to bother you. I just want you to know that you're a big fan of mine." "Well, I am, madam, I am, you know." And all those stories that every comic will always bring out to you about someone running after Richard Todd and saying, "Aren't you Richard Todd in later life?" Or to Hermione Gingell, "Do you know how I recognised you? By your face." And I've done it myself. I was once so embarrassed at a Variety Club Awards lunch that somebody came up to me and asked me for my autograph when Maggie Smith was sitting next to me that I actually signed it Maggie Smith. A little confusing for the person who was there. I went through the normal channels of drama school and getting my first job and all that. And I, you know, I've thought hard about whether to tell you all those stories, but I've sort of written them and told them over the years. And so I fear they would not be very fresh. But there's one that I can't resist telling you again. And that's when I was in Manchester at a small theatre that was formed by Granada Television. And they were so extraordinary. They didn't know anything about the theatre, but we had this wonderful company with really, really good actors, John Fraser, John Shrapnel, Andre Van Gijsig, and Maureen Pryor. And it was there that I met Jack, my husband-to-be. And I took Jack home to Hull. It was the first boyfriend I'd been able to take home to Hull, because the first Jewish boyfriend I'd had. And of course, we were put in separate bedrooms, and during the night, I couldn't sleep, and I sort of was wandering about on tiptoe, and my mother said, "Can't you sleep, love?" I said, "No." She said, "Oh, pop in for a minute." She said, "I haven't talked to you for ages." So I popped in and sat on the bed, and my dad was sort of tossing and turning, and finally he said, "What the hell are you talking about, you two? Middle of the bloody night," he said. "What's going on here?" So my mother said to him, "Well, I haven't talked to her for ages. You go and sleep in her room, and she can sleep in here with me." And at 6 a.m, my husband, fiancé-to-be at that stage, got out of bed, crept across the corridor, knelt down by the bed, kissed my father on the back of the neck, and got into bed with him. And things were never the same. And then I came back from Manchester to join the Old Vic Company, which was Sir Laurence Olivier's company in the last 3 years at the Old Vic. And that was the happiest and the best theatrical experience of my life. Oddly so, because actually what I was doing was understudying of Dog's Body, you know. And I used to cycle from Hampstead every day to the Old Vic with my crocheting in the front basket. And I would understudy, and I would stay there long after the show was over. The company was, you know, Albert Finney, Maggie Smith, Derek Jacobi, Billy Whitelaw, Colin Blakely, and that was my learning place. I mean, I did learn at drama school, but I remember, you know, when I left drama school, the principal saying to me, "You've got to be very patient, Maureen, because you won't come into your own till you're 40. And I burst into tears, because there was no such age at 40, is there, when you're 40? Doesn't exist, does it, when you're 19? So, and then suddenly, you know, the whole thing just accelerates, and before you can blink, and you've got these babies, you know, you bring them home, and this little thing lies in your arms, and it looks at you with perfect knowledge. "You're not qualified for this job," it says. And it's right. And you put a few meatballs in the oven and you put a bit of moisturiser on your neck, and the next thing you know, that same child is patting you on the head as they leave at 12 o'clock at night and say, "Don't wait up for me, I'm off to get rat-arsed." He was still in bed when I left, 2 o'clock. And then my daughter, who was just the most eccentric child, literally dressed as Queen Victoria for 2 years. Every day, a long black dress and a fresh doily on her head. Don't ask me. I think I blame the father. One of the dear stories about Amy was that in the GCSEs at 16, she was in the biology paper, for which I think she got 8%, which I was very pleased because I got 7%. She was asked, "Why is artificial insemination preferable to normal breeding methods in cows?" And Amy had replied, "Because it's nicer for the cow." I see a lot of a grandmother in that. This is, after all, the woman who I took my mother to a Greek restaurant. And as we were getting out the car, she said, "You know what I'm going to have? I'm having that thing I had last time, the fellatio and chips. It was marvellous." "Oh, I hope it's on," I said, you know. I was doing a holiday programme in Southwold with my mother. And I explained to her what happens. You know, they're going to mic us up. They're going to put a mic on us. And then we walk down the street and the camera will be in front of us and we talk to the camera. "Oh, yes," she said. She wasn't listening to me at all. Why break the habits of a lifetime? So we walk down the street of this lovely little village and the camera's in front. And I said to her, "Well, what do you think of the place, Mum?" "Oh," she said, "it's lovely, isn't it? Nice, so quaint, isn't it? Look, and the hotel, isn't it clean? Wonderful." So I said, "So would you come here with a friend for a weekend?" Me? She said, come here. No, I'd be bored stiff. Cut. And then we walked down a hill into a little shop in Walberswick. So we had to do it once as a rehearsal. And I asked her a question again, and she answered on the way down. And the next time, I said, right, go again. Came to the top, and I said, so shall we go and have a look in that shop on the way down, Mum? Shall we just been in it? There was nothing we liked. This is the woman who specialises in the rhetorical question. Why is it funny? I don't know. You might not think it is, but it's funny when someone says, oh, aren't eggs useful? And once, when we were watching the film Chariots of Fire, she leant across and said, do you like films about running? And almost my favourite was when I opened in a one-man show, Live and Kidding. She said to me the next day, you know, there was a man sitting next to me and I think he was a critic. Oh, I said, why should... He was making notes all the way through the first half. Right, I said, but he didn't come back for the second half. So I thought, that's not very good. He's going to review the whole show. So I rang the press officer and I said, you know, apparently there was a critic in last night and he didn't come back for the second half of the show. He was sitting next to my mother. Oh, she said, I'll check up on it and I'll call you back. She called me back and she said, yes, she said he was there for the second half. He had to move because some woman was looking at his notes all the way through the show. I think it's very hard, if you've got a funny angle on life, to live in the present, because you're always looking to comment on the past. And I think the secret of life, probably, certainly according to Joyce Grenfell, a great heroine of mine, is living in the present. She said, there's no such thing as time, only this minute, and I'm in it, thank the Lord. Well, I mean, I loved Joyce when I was a child, and it's an ongoing love. And I remember very clearly when I had the show on in London, a one-woman show, it was about 2 hours long, and a cabbie driving me in said to me, who's in it with you then, Maureen? I said, nobody, it's a one-woman show. He said, how long is it? I said, it's about 2 hours. Ooh, God, you see, that must be bleeding boring. No, I don't mean for you, I mean for the audience. Yeah. And there's another wonderful occasion where somebody was heard going out, one of Joyce's people, obviously, saying, when did she die? And the other one said, Joyce Grenfell or Maureen Lipman. Overhearings are just so wonderful, aren't they? I know Alan Bennett's a great one for listening, and so is listening in, so was Joyce, and so is Victoria Wood, and I think it informs their work. And one of my favourites was the American couple sitting absolutely silently in a restaurant for the whole meal. It becomes riveting to your sort of third ear. And finally, he leant across and said something to her, and she said, it's not the buff bung in yon, Henry. It's the last 23 years. Some people ask, you know, whether the image you create of yourself is real or whether it's just another mask. And actually, you know, I mean, I've written 6 volumes of sort of anecdotal autobiography, and it's all true. Every single thing has happened, but I would say that in no way was that an autobiography. I don't think that's peculiar to me, because I've read every word that Joyce Grenfell has written, and I know now that somebody is writing a biography of her, which will be quite, in many ways, quite different from her own, because you only give in a biography, an autobiography, what you want to be read, clearly. And in my case, the image is of someone who's kind of ditzy and chaotic and everything just happens to by chance. Now, that seems to me to be the way it is, but I don't know. You may look and see a very ambitious, very calculating woman. It seems to me that I just muddle through and people say, how have you done it with children? Well, the answer is I had a string of au pairs, and that in itself is a sitcom. You know, the Australian one who came one night and the following morning we heard a male voice on the stairs saying, hi, how do you do? Hello, I'm Rob. And the Qantas pilot had been in her room all night. She didn't even settle in, you know. And she was the one who was absolutely terrible with the children, hopeless. And I'd had these wonderful references for her from a nursery in a Bogland somewhere in Queensland. And finally I said, Sandy, I said, you know, can I just ask you something about your references? How many children were you looking after in the nursery? She said, hey, how do you mean? I said, how many children were in your care? She said, no, not children, pot plants. I'm going to have a column soon in the internet, an internet column in the Daily Express, which is an oxymoron in itself. But I reckon that if an idiot like me can learn, then anybody can learn. In fact, I've got these. I must just read you a couple of these because these are from the personal adverts on the internet, which I've alighted on almost by mistake. And I just love them. They are from a Jewish chat line. Divorced Jewish man seeks partner to attend shul with, light Shabbos candles, celebrate holidays, build sukkah together, attend brises and bar mitzvahs. Religion not important. Wonderful. Sincere rabbinical student 27 enjoys Yom Kippur, Tisha B'Av, Ta'anis, Esther, Psalm Gadilia, Asara B'Teva, Shiva Asa, Bet Samutz, seeks companion for living life in the fast lane. Female graduate student studying Kabbalah, Zohar, exorcism of Dibbuks, seeks mensch, no weirdos please. Oh, and I love this one. Israeli professor, 41, with 18 years of teaching in my behind. Looking for American woman who speaks English very goodly. And this is my very favourite. I am a sensitive Jewish prince who you can open your heart to, share your innermost thoughts and deepest secrets. Confide in me. I'll understand your insecurities. No fatties, please. Which brings me to a little song. I wrote this, not for me, actually, although it's got some of me in it. I really wrote it to send to some country western singer or, you know, Elkie Brooks, maybe. Somebody who could give it a kind of raunchy feel, but I never had the courage to send it. So that's why I'm trying it out on you. It's called the Hot Flush Blues. I won't attempt to sing it, but it goes, I just passed 50 and I'm given into gravity. I got my tongue in a real deep cavity. I'm looking round for signs of depravity. I'm long in the tooth, short on love. I want to make love when I'm not too tired. I want to wear a bra that ain't underwired. Want to watch Tina Turner and get inspired, because I'm long in the tooth, short on love. Now, I could paint my own pottery and bake my own bread. I say the day that I do that's the day that I'm dead. I don't want cameo brooches or organized coaches. I want to smoke roaches and get out of my head. I won't see a shrink, I got no neuroses. I won't watch the soaps and get my kicks by osmosis. I won't read those pamphlets on osteoporosis, because I'm long in the tooth, short on love. Don't give me lavender and lace, unless that lace is black. I want a facelift, not a stair lift, and I ain't coming back. I want to sit down and overdose on aphrodisiac, because I'm long in the tooth, short on love.